History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, do they have to go untold? No, not if we're willing to do something about it. It can be as simple as asking a few questions and taking the time to listen, which is exactly what we've had the privilege of doing on this program now for 15 years. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You heard me say 15 years, and yeah, this weekend marks the 15th anniversary of the very first episode of Hometown Heroes, which we're going to hear some excerpts of today. But before I go any further, I just want to say thank you. Thank you to all of you who listen to Hometown Heroes and thus have helped keep it on the air all these years, growing to more and more partnering radio stations along the way. We can thank them too, the stations, and a huge thank you to those of you who have let me know about the heroes in your life who were so often way too humble to draw any attention to themselves. It's been listener suggestions that have led us to just about every veteran you've heard share his or her story here. And the biggest thank you of all, of course, goes to the hundreds and hundreds of veterans all over this country who have not only welcomed me into their homes, but have invited all of us into some memories that aren't always easy to talk about, but produce such a lasting impact on our perspective. Hometown Heroes has never been just about looking back in time, but also about what an awareness of the past can mean for our present and our future. I'm not sure what the next 15 years might hold, but I decided to do a little counting this week, and it turns out we've had the privilege of sitting down with veterans in 41 of the 50 states and the District of Columbia, of course. For those 9 states we haven't made it to physically yet, we've featured veterans who grew up in all of those places, and the unique memories that all of them have tapped into have taken us into so many different corners of World War II, throughout Europe and the Pacific, the China-Burma-India theater, even places like Canada, South America, or Russia. Whether a vet served in the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Merchant Marine, the Army Air Corps, the OSS, even some of those amazing ladies we refer to as Rosie the Riveters who are making it happen on the home front. Men and women from every corner of the country, every tax bracket, all areas of the political spectrum, many different religious backgrounds, and every ethnic or racial identity, the tapestry that their stories have collectively provided is one that points us in many ways to the best of what America can be when a common goal and purpose unite us. I'm sure there'll be a few more sentimental thoughts to share along the way today, but I want to take you back to our very first episode. It aired live from the studios of KMJ Radio in Fresno, California on October 7th, 2007, promoting and building upon a local television feature called Stories of Service that I'd been producing for a few years at that point. A few minutes on television couldn't capture nearly as much as an entire hour on radio, as we learned from a retired middle school teacher named Augie Macaluso and another special guest who called in to surprise him. The son of a World War I veteran, Augie grew up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and was studying engineering at Vanderbilt University as part of the Army Specialized Training Program when the urgent need for infantrymen cut short those studies and sent him to Europe with the 106th Infantry Division.
We relieved the 2nd Infantry Division, the 23rd Regiment, and they had moved all the way up to the Siegfried Line, but then had to pull back because of the lack of supplies. But they had dug in pretty heavily, and they had good fortifications that we assumed. As they left, they said, "You lucky guys, you're in a quiet zone. You really have it made." Well, that didn't last very long.
December 16th.
Exactly 5:30 in the morning, December 16th, the German artillery opened up with a barrage that lasted for nearly an hour. If you would liken yourself to being in an aluminum or a metal shed and had somebody throwing gravel at you, that's what it sounded like when we were in this earthen bunker. There were our shells all around the area. Fortunately, there were no direct hits.
and the intelligence for the Americans, there had been a couple things that have been picked up that maybe could have indicated that that surprise attack was coming, a massive offensive with a 250,000 German troops or what would become the Battle of the Bulge. But at that time, no one put all those pieces to the puzzle together to let you guys know that this was coming. You had no idea, right?
Well, not really. We didn't know about the massiveness. We knew that something was happening because we could hear sounds at night. The Germans flew a plane much like a small one-wing plane because the noise that it sent up and down the line drowned out the movement of the Germans behind their lines. And they were moving tanks and infantry driven by trucks and horse-drawn in some cases up to get ready to have the original attack. We knew something was going to happen, but we had no idea it was going to be as massive as it was.
And you did all right the first day, surprised as you were, but it wasn't long before you ran into something that you weren't exactly prepared for, at least that you had no chance to fight against. Tell me about that.
That's true. The outfit to the left of us was overrun, and we in turn were overrun by the Germans. And directly in front of us was a minefield, heavily mined. It had been mined by the Germans when they withdrew. It was mined by the 2nd Infantry Division when they were there, and we were there long enough to put some mines out. So you didn't dare go out into that territory unless you had a guide who knew exactly where the mines were. So when the Germans came in and captured us, they told us that by putting Schmeisser machine pistols to our head, that we had to move across that minefield. Well, we were reluctant, but when you're looking at a Schmeisser machine pistol, you decide that you'd better go.
And that's what some people affectionately have dubbed, or maybe disaffectionately have dubbed, a burp gun, because in what sounds like one short burp, it can get off, what, 1,400 rounds a minute or something like that?
1,400 rounds a minute, that's true. In order to go across, we had to go over a double-apron barbed wire fence that was shaped like the letter A, with strands of barbed wire on each side. You had to pick your way over. As a result, I was the last one in the group, and I was the last one with a German right next to me. There were artillery shells coming in at that time because we had asked for close fire. These were American artillery shells. And the German who was right next to me was as frightened as I was. He ran up a number of yards in front of me, and when he did that, I moved off to the left as fast as I could and made a headlong dive into a snowbank.
Knowing full well that when you try something like that, they're liable to turn one of those Schmeissers on you and let loose, right?
Yes, I felt that could happen at any second.
But it didn't.
Fortunately, no. And it was almost twilight, almost dusk at that time. And when I went in, I just didn't move. I stayed in position for endless amount of time. After about 3 or 4 hours, I looked around to pull my head out of the helmet because my helmet had frozen in the snow. I pulled my head back and tried to locate where I was, but I couldn't get any direction at all. Finally, German artillery illuminated some of the buildings in the little village that we had been protecting. And I knew now what direction to go.
And that was the village of Heckescheid, I believe, correct?
Yes, it was. I had my fists, which were underneath me, were now frozen solid. So the only way I could find my way out was to put my fists into the footprints that I had made as I dove into that area. As I did that, my right hand hit something metallic, and I realized it was probably a mine called a Bouncing Betty or a Bouncing Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me another half hour to move after that because I was really frightened when I realized I only missed that by a number of inches.
Now, you knew which direction you were heading in, but did you know who had control of that area where you were headed?
I did not know at that particular time. The only thing I did know that about 50 yards on each side of me, I could hear Germans talking. So I'm now in the German lines. And before I made this burst to go across there, the American artillery started a fire in that area. So I had gone through a German artillery fire a couple of days before, and now I am enduring an American artillery fire. And their bits of shrapnel were coming right over me, and you could hear them just twisting and turning and singing as they would land in the snow. It really frightened me. When I hit that double apron barbed wire fence, running up to it, I felt as though I was running on my knees because my legs were so frozen. I hit that double log fence and flipped over and then began to run, expecting any minute to have bullets hitting me in the back because the Germans weren't that far from me. Apparently, they were as surprised as I was to be out there. As I got closer to the position that we had held before I was captured, I heard somebody say, halt.
Uh-oh.
Halt is the same in German as it is in English, but this one had a little bit of a southern tinge to it, and I knew it had to be Captain Comer my captain from Alabama. It was, and I was home safe, at least for a while.
Prayers answered, at least for now.
Yes.
And you reported to him what had happened?
I reported to him what had happened. I told him about the position of the Germans, where they were firing, when they were firing. I told him what happened to our squad, that all of them had been captured, including myself, but I was the only one who got away. That included my squad leader, and my assistant squad leader. The assistant squad leader was wounded at the particular time when we were captured from those artillery shells that came in. I learned later that he died in a prisoner of war camp. But my sergeant, Sergeant Roberts, is alive. He survived, and I'm still in contact with him these many years later.
I want to talk about Sergeant Roberts. The day that the attack started, December 16th, he had a little problem with his wristwatch?
Yes, his GI watch malfunctioned. And he said to me, Mac, he referred to me as Mac, would you mind letting me have your wristwatch? And I was reluctant to do it because this had been a Christmas gift, an early Christmas gift to me, given to me by parents before we left to come overseas. And I said, yes, I'll give it to you, but whatever you do, please return it. Well, he was taken prisoner, and he was in prison until late May of 1945.
And in a POW camp, if you have something like a watch, that's going to be hard to keep without trading it in for something or out having it confiscated, I imagine.
Yes, he could have sold or given it away, sold it, whatever. He could have bribed the Germans with it. He could have had food, whatever he needed, he could have had if he would give up that watch. But he did not.
He did not, but you didn't get it back. And years passed. And at this point, I want to bring in another guest to the program. A little bit of a surprise for you here, Augie, someone who knows the story that we're talking about. We have Stuart Stern with us from Seattle, Washington. Stuart is an Academy Award-nominated screenwriter, won an Emmy Award for his work. But back in 1944, he was in Europe, too, with the 106th. And, Stuart, I understand that in 1977, you arranged a meeting between Augie and Sergeant Roberts.
I guess I did. It's hard to remember back that far. I remember the bulge better than 1977. Hi, Augie.
Hi, Stuart. This is a surprise. A real surprise. So good to hear you.
And maybe not as big a surprise as what happened at that dinner in 1977. Augie, tell us what you experienced while you were waiting for dessert.
Well, we were waiting for dessert. Sergeant Roberts leaned over to me and he said, Augie, I have something that I want to give to you that I promised I would return. And at that moment, he gave me the watch. 33 years later, I had my watch back.
And it still works?
It still works. It's kept in a safe deposit box at the bank, but one of our children will get it eventually, I'm sure.
Stuart, I want to ask you, as the witness to that reunion of Augie and his watch, which obviously there are a few more things more important to him than his watch, but a pretty special moment for him at that point. Do you recall his reaction, the expression on his face, what that moment was like to be sitting there with him?
Well, it was a mixed moment. He was thrilled to get the watch, but not entirely thrilled about where it had been, because Sergeant Roberts, when he was captured by the Germans, knew that he had his honor pledged on protecting that watch. And the big question was where would he be able to hide it? And he finally, literally, found a place on his anatomy where that watch would be safe and where nobody could possibly have found it. And I don't think I'll go into details, but that watch has been to places that most of us have never been. And still, when he handed it to Augie, Augie was just thrilled to death.
Well, Augie conveniently left those details out the first time he told me about that, so I'm glad that you were able to bring the full depth of that story and the efforts to which Sergeant Roberts went.
Well, I think anything, you know, the battle was so extreme that it took, you didn't care how extreme you had to be to protect the things that you cared about, because the smallest thing became, especially if it was lent to you by a friend, the most important thing in the world.
Well, and Stuart, I want to talk to you about some of your experiences briefly, too. I know that you were not captured that day with Augie and the other 11. You had been trying to save your feet from frostbite, those horrible winter conditions, one of the worst winters ever in Europe. But I understand that when you heard they were captured, it was such a big deal that you rushed out of the schoolhouse where you guys were holed up and you forgot something down there?
Yeah. I forgot my helmet. I actually heard them being captured because Godfrey was on the radio, you know, the hand voice-powered radio, and we heard the whole thing when he was saying that one of our fellows had been shot in that trench, which we could almost see down the hill through the trees ahead of us, even though it was night. And shortly after that capture, when that phone went dead, and it was the last we heard of Godfrey until after the war.
And when he refers to Godfrey, that's the same Sergeant Roberts that we've been discussing.
Yeah, and we were, then all hell broke loose outside of the schoolhouse where we were hiding in the company or the platoon headquarters down there in the bottom of the schoolhouse. And Sergeant Godreau said, "We're being attacked, everybody. Get up and, you know, grab something, and we're going to have to go into those woods and shoot whoever is there. And we went storming up the steps, and I just forgot my helmet, which I left in that cellar.
How long was it till you got another helmet?
Well, I'm not even sure that I did get another. I think I had no helmet, and I had my pants ripped off on a barbed wire fence. I don't think I ever recovered a helmet.
But you, after the war, and you were able to hold on to all your appendages despite the severe frostbite that you were facing. I know they wanted to amputate at one point, and you found a way to prevent them from doing that.
Yeah.
But you went into Hollywood and into the film business, had a very successful career, a legendary career as a screenwriter. And at one point, you went back to that same area where you had been when you were looking to make a movie back there. Is that correct?
Yep. Schnapp sitting, looking out over this peaceful pasture, which had been the enemy front in front of us, right between the Siegfried line and our front lines, and just couldn't believe. But spring was coming, everything was gorgeous, and the teacher asked me, I told him that we had burst out of that cellar and it was the last time I'd ever seen it. And I said, "I'd love to go in the school and see what it's like with children in it." So he took me back into the place, and it was wonderful. The kids were singing, and then he took me down into the cellar. He said, "Maybe you want to see this again." And to go down those steps that I had last come up in 1944 just chilled me. And then he went into the corner, and he came back with a helmet full of nails, and he said, "Is this yours?" And mine had been creased across the front of it. I don't know what had happened. It was dented, but it was my helmet. He said that he had a feeling that whoever left it there might someday come back, and he was waiting to give it back to me.
And I imagine that with all the friends that you have who people would know and love from Hollywood and the unbelievable career you've had, I imagine that moment was as special for you as anything else that you've experienced.
Oh, it was. It was like the completion of a circle. But that whole visit to Hekushide that day was a remarkable one because I had shot a boy from my position who had hung on the wire in front of it for 3 days until we got out of there, and I couldn't get close, or there was, you know, it was just war. And when I went into the village, I had a smell of death was everywhere, but my friend couldn't smell it, the guy who came with me. And I went back to that position where that kid had been stretched on the wire, and I just stopped and said a prayer there. And I'm not a very devout person, but the minute I had said the prayer for him, the smell of death went away.
Wow. That is a powerful story. Thank you for sharing that with us. And Stuart, thank you very much for your service to our country and for giving our culture such great legacies as well through your work as a screenwriter.
Give Augie my love.
He's still here. I was going to say, is there anything else that you think maybe he neglected to tell us that you want to embarrass him with while you're still together?
No,
I don't want to embarrass him anymore. I think I probably did enough.
Thank you, good buddy.
Okay.
Stuart Stern passed away in 2015, Augie Macaluso 5 years later, not long after Augie finally agreed to visit Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. He had turned down 18 previous opportunities to do so because he didn't want to spend 3 days away from his beloved wife, Ida. So that was from our very first episode 15 years ago this weekend. And when we come back, we'll try to bring back some more special memories for you. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.